Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today on Living Mythology, I'm proud to bring you the Pep Talk with John Carl Pepe. Greetings and welcome, John. How are you?
Excellent, Hercules. How are you?
I'm doing great, and I'm looking forward to your show today, as all your shows.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Well, you know what I'm looking forward to? I'm looking forward to July 8th with Thor, Love, and Thunder. And it looks like, according to the rumors, we were on the money, man.
Yes, I've seen, so, I've seen images.
Yes, your namesake will finally make the long-awaited Marvel Cinematic Universe debut. So very excited to talk with you about that once all is revealed on the screen itself.
We will do so.
Very good, very good.
So tell me about your show tonight.
Sure. Well, this is our 4th of July spectacular. So ladies and gentlemen,
awesome.
Thank you for joining us for the pep talk. We're going to take a little trip to the past. So if you grew up in the New York City area in the years before podcasts and satellite radio, you would know that the biggest game in broadcasting was terrestrial radio. And in a market overrun with zoo crews and shock jocks, 101.1 WCBS-FM was the defining soundtrack to New York City life. Playing hits from the past out of a building known as Black Rock, WCBS-FM dominated the airwaves. And my very guest tonight was there for it all. Like James Kirk captaining the Enterprise through the final frontier, my guest tonight led a crew of some of radio's greatest personalities for almost a quarter of a century. It is my sincerest pleasure to introduce you to the man who let me co-opt the title of this very show and indirectly helped my father put me through college, the one, the only, the legendary, and the real Joe McCoy.
That's pretty funny. He put you through college on that, huh?
Thanks.
How are you doing, John?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for being here. It is an honor to have you, sir.
My pleasure. It's my pleasure. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it really has. It really has. So, we're just going to get right into it, and then, maybe we'll have a little chance to reminisce a little bit down the road in the hour. First and foremost, for those who really don't know the inner workings of the radio business way back then, especially, you were the program director for WCBS-FM from 1981 to 2004.
Right.
So really, let's start with what exactly does a program director do? Because I feel like those who probably only know the inner workings of radio from WKRP in Cincinnati, I guess your equivalent on that show would be the role Gary Sandy played, right?
Yeah, kind of. But he was on the air, and when I became the program director at CBS-FM, I gave up my air work. Basically, what a program director does, though, John, is to oversee everything that goes on the air. My job was to, corral all the disc jockeys and get the guys I wanted on the air. And same thing with the news department. And, I coordinated with the promotion department on the promotion things that we worked on, and along with contests and things like that. And, I oversaw all of the music that goes on the radio station. We had a music director, but it was really a lot of that stuff is what I wanted to happen on the radio station, and that's basically what a program director does, and he monitors that every single day, listens to the people on the air, listens to the music, makes sure the rotation is correct, makes sure the guys are having fun on the air and doing the right things, and whatever it takes to make us a great radio station.
There, you definitely did your job there. You really, at that time period in that market, you guys, like I said before, you kind of dominated. Now, part of it was because you had a great format that was really just universal to everybody, which was the oldies format. Now, from what I understand, the oldies format was there before you took over as program director, but you were as a DJ there, you were. The oldies format had been already set.
Right. The oldies format was there in 1972. That's when CBS FM switched over from, well, I guess you'd call it quasi-rock format or AOR rock format. And then in 1972, they changed to oldies, and the station went through the roof. And and then later on, you know, like with anything, sometimes when things go through the roof, you know, they calm down. And when I got there in 1981, when they asked me to be the program director, when I walked in there, the station was probably at its lowest rating period. And so that was a big job to turn the station around and, you know, try to figure out what's wrong here. You know, and the music was great, we thought, and some other things. But we went through some focus groups, and the focus groups basically told us what we needed to know. And that was that most people thought that CBS FM was a doo-wop radio station. That's what they thought about it. And so my job was to say, okay, what can we do to make this different? So we focused on the 60s, and we said, okay, we're going to play more Beatles, and we're going to play more Beach Boys. We're going to play more Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons, and you know, stuff like that really emphasized the 60s. And I wanted to bring that, you know, into people's mind that we're just not a 50s radio station. We're a 60s radio station. We play 70s music. And when I was there, we even did a thing called Future Gold, so that once or twice an hour we would play a current song. And it would be a current song that was basically on the adult contemporary charts. Obviously, it's not going to be a hard rock contemporary song, but it was stuff that fit our format. And so we were, you know, and again, we were the atypical oldies station, because most oldies stations did not play any current music. As a matter of fact, you know, they would sit in their little cocoons and wonder how the heck we could do this. But we did.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that I thought was very fascinating, you know, in doing my research and seeing how the format, you know, was tweaked and adjusted over the years, especially under your tenure, starting to shave back a little bit of the older stuff, you know, shaving back on like 50 through 55 and then concentrating on that meat, you said, like of the 60s and introducing more rock bands from the 60s. And then, yeah, that attempt to, you know, play a little bit of contemporary under this very good sort of, you know, rigid structure. I dig that, you know, and especially if, you know, say Smokey Robinson has a song that comes out, you know, it's a new Smokey Robinson song that gets into that rotation. So a sort of a fearlessness about what you guys did and a confidence with what you were doing. And you also had some of the best DJs in the business at the time. You know, what was it like working with the likes of Cousin Brucey and Max Kinkle and you know, Harry Harrison? You know, let's get into a little bit about some of the talent you had to corral.
Well, we had some great guys, and Harry was at the radio station a year before I got there as the program director, and you know, once I got there, I brought in – Cousin Brucey was actually the first guy I brought in because we had a Saturday night opening, and Cousin Brucey was – he was in station ownership, and he had a station in Morristown, New Jersey, and he had a station in upstate New York in Middletown. And so Cousin Brucey was basically off the New York City airways for 5 years, and he and I worked together as disc jockeys at WNBC back in 1976 and 77. So I was on a train going home to Connecticut, and I was reading this Cashbox magazine, which is an old records magazine, and it said Cousin Brucey was working, you know, and running these two stations in the suburbs. And I said, my God, Cousin Brucey, he would be perfect for Saturday nights. So I called Bruce up and I said, hey, look, you know, you haven't been in the city for 5 years, and New York needs you back. New York needs you on the radio. And so Bruce acquiesced, and, you know, it was probably one of the best hires I ever made. And, of course, we had a lot of good people there. I brought in Bob Shannon also, and Bob did Afternoon Drive for us. Excuse me. And, you know, and later on, we, you know, brought in guys like Dan Ingram and Dandy Dan Daniel, and, of course, one of my favorites, Ron Lundy. I think Ron was the second guy we brought in there. And, yes. And Ron was one of those guys who could make your day just by looking at him, because he was he was so cheerful and so fun. You know, he's like a teddy bear. And so we brought that into the situation, and of course, you know, Harry Harrison in the morning had worked for WMCA and worked for WABC, and when he worked for those radio stations, he basically just had a newsman, and that was it. And so we had had Mr. G there already also, so he was the weatherman there. And I just, you know, I had an idea, because I think, you know, I'm into sports. And I think what was missing from a lot of radio stations, New York radio stations, was, you know, any semblance of sports information. Because we tried to be a full-service radio station to our listeners. And I said, we got to get somebody in here who understands sports, because, believe it or not, a lot of newsmen at radio stations, you know, have no idea about sports. And there's some disc jockeys that don't either. And so I said, I've got to get an authority on this radio station. And I said to myself, you know, I always read Phil Pepe's column in the New York Daily News. And he always seemed like a very fair writer. You know, he never leaned to one side or the other side. It was always like right down the middle. So I said, you know, I think he'd be really good, you know. So I called your dad up and, you know, asked him if he would be interested, and asked him if he had any radio experience and, you know, if he'd like to do this. And he said, yeah. He said, I think I would. And so we brought him on, and so your dad brought an awful lot to the radio station in many ways in that morning show, because he was a big part of it. And also bringing in the pep talk, your dad, I know you know, and folks out there may know, and some who don't, John's dad did a feature in afternoon drive around 6 o'clock on WCBS-FM, and it was called the pep talk, and it was kind of a 1-minute wrap on the sports of the day or the sports of yesterday or whatever topic he chose. And, you know, and he was very, very good at that. He was a great writer. As you know, he's written a million books. And and the best thing about it, John, is that he introduced me to Mickey Mantle and Billy Martin. So, you know.
Yep. Hey, me too. We got that.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure.
Well, I mean, so, you know, as people probably know, you know, my father is no longer here to speak with us. Last time I did see you was at his funeral. And again, thank you for being there for that and being supportive. But, you know, from my recollection, it was probably my father's favorite steady gig outside of, you know, being a beat reporter and being paid to go to baseball games every night of his life. I, as far as a get up, get ready, go to work, do this thing kind of gig, he absolutely loved it. He loved being part of that environment. He loved the people he got to work with. You know, one such person I always think about that he every time Richard Simmons would come in, my dad said it was the greatest time ever, you know. So he loved the exposure. He loved the opportunity to do the pep talk for the drive, the afternoon drive. It just really was, I think, his favorite regular gig. And even though he, you know, would grumble and gripe about getting up at 4:30 in the morning, he got used to it, and he actually embraced that too and used that to, you know, really kickstart his day. So, you know, on behalf of him, if he never got to tell you this, from my opinion, from my insider perspective, yeah, he treasured his time there.
Well, I'm glad, because he, you know, it's great to have someone like Phil be part of the morning team. And we have all the guys, and including Albert Tucci, who was who was called Engineer Al, who basically ran the board and produced part of the show. You know, they were all great people, everybody at that radio station, on the air and off. We had a wonderful bunch of people, and that's probably why your dad liked coming in there so much, because, you know, everybody would kid around, you know, we all got along, and that was what it was all about.
Yeah, I mean, it was a really, you know, loose but structured environment. In fact, I remember they put me on the air at 11 years old, I think, and my father had taken me to a professional wrestling, a WWF, wrestling event. And I think Hulk Hogan, I think, was wrestling, and they kind of did the intro as if it was going to be my dad, and Harry turned it over to me, and I actually was on, my first stab at being on the airwaves, so to speak, was with that, giving my opinion of the Hulk Hogan match from the night before.
Which great. So you made your radio debut.
I made my radio debut. I don't know. I thought they ran it by you. one of the things I always loved.
You know, it's I gave the guys, anything that made sense. They all knew that, and that's the whole structure of the radio station. Is having people in there that are creative, people who know what to do and what is right and what is not right, what is fun, what is going to touch the audience, and those are the guys I tried to hire for my radio station, because guys who took charge, guys who knew what to do, guys who were responsible and professional.
Well, and I was just going to say that one of the things that I loved watching. Was in between, coming out of the commercial breaks, and to see Harry there, tell the engineer, okay, we're going to go with the Beep Beeps promo, and then we're going to do this, and I'm going to go into this, and then we're going to turn it over to Phil, and just to see, that's what a DJ did. He didn't just, play records, that he really plotted the course of the listener's journey. Which I thought was really fascinating, and that was your philosophy. Let the DJs run their show, and people will respond. And I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, I think that's what's important. A lot of people think that the DJ plays the record, it wasn't a record then, but whatever it was, CD
or a cassette. They were carts. Yes, they were carts back then. Yeah.
So it was, and then while that thing is playing, the DJ is thinking about what he's going to do next, and back when I was on the air, when we didn't have, board ops and stuff like that, we ran the boards ourselves. I can tell you, when I was at WORFM in New York City, we had to pick, like, if you had one record on, you had to pick the next song out of a book. And you have to go through this book, this loose leaf binder, and then you also had to see that you couldn't pick a song that was played like yesterday, an oldie I'm talking about, or the day before. You had to have a 2-day window between each time that song was played. So when you're thinking about, the DJ is really thinking, and back then, they were certainly thinking about what the heck they're doing next and trying to get it done within the span of that song being played on the air. And even more so on CBS FM, when you're dealing with songs that are 2.5 and 3.5 minutes,
Yeah. And it's so interesting that, because, right around that time that you were at CBS FM, you started to see this big push towards corporate run radio, and a preset playlist, to a point where it got, they didn't even need DJs. It was all just pre-programmed into a computer, and you just needed a guy just to come in and say the name of the station, and that was it, So really it was an incredible...
Well, it was never like that on our radio station. We did pick out the music, and, that was all done through computer, and that started somewhere around, I guess, 1983, something like that. Before that, the jocks picked the music, but... having been a jock there, I could tell you, the guy on the air would rather pick his favorites. I know when I was on the air, I'd rather pick Marvin Gaye singing "Stubborn Kind of Fellow" than I would Marvin Gaye "I Heard It Through the Grapevine," which was a bigger hit. So that's basically what guys were doing. So they weren't playing all the biggest hits, and that's what the computer did. Basically, was to take over that. So that guys wouldn't have the freedom of choice anymore.
Yeah. You're right, because I know as a listener, I always appreciate the deep cuts, right? The stuff that you're not going to hear 4 or 5 different times a day, sometimes even on the same station, it got to a point,
Well, we did have those things, too. We would surprise you with something from left field every once in a while. And that's that gave it the variety, you know. People would say, "Wow, you have a big playlist." Well, we really didn't have a big playlist. We had we had a good sized playlist, but we had a lot of songs, let's say on the side, that we would throw in every once in a while, and people would hear this every once in a while and say, "Wow, that's a they got a huge playlist," you know. But it wasn't really that way.
Right, but also for them, for the listener, to hear that and to have, you know, oh, I haven't heard this song in years, and then to have that memory, you know, of the last time they heard that song, or that, you know, to really connect with them in that way. I think those rarities like that, you know, I think that's kind of what keeps people listening.
Absolutely.
You know, right,
it's a variety, you know, the Sirius does that very well. They play a lot of Sirius XM does a lot of variety. They play things that I wouldn't even play. You know, they play some stuff that I'm like, oh my God. But you know, it's variety, and they're dealing with the national audience, whereas we were dealing with, you know, the audience in the tri-state area.
Yeah. There's a term in broadcasting, TSL, right? Time spent listening. And it's all about keeping that listener, you know, and I think about, I'm going to dovetail a little bit here, and how things have changed, but have also stayed the same. So I'm thinking about 1986, right? And a movie comes out called Stand By Me, and Stand By Me plays a lot of the songs that were your bread and butter at CBS FM.
Right.
And for a kid like me, an 11-year-old like me, seeing this movie, being, you know, really into the movie and having the soundtrack to go with it, you know, of course, that movie was hugely popular. So those songs, boom, they're already or are now plugged into the CBS FM rotation. And now we flash forward, and I think of, you know, what's happening now with you know, a show like Stranger Things on Netflix uses a Kate Bush song from 1986. That all of a sudden now people are rediscovering that song, you know, and how the way we can look to the past, the facilitator has changed with the technology, but that intent is still there, or that end result is still there, which I always found very fascinating when you're talking about pop culture, and especially back before everything was at your fingertips in an instant.
Well, you know, also
when you were running.
You've seen it in commercials also, you know, when they brought, I was talking about I Heard It Through the Grapevine, you know, when they had the raisins and the singing I Heard It Through the Grapevine. And I mean, you still see it today. And they pick these songs out. I mean, I don't know who picks them out, but I keep thinking it's probably somebody, some guy my age is picking them out. But, you know, it's great to hear that stuff. And it's, you know, you talked about the Stand By Me album. And my son, I think, was about a year younger than you. He brought that album and he started playing it one day. And I'm saying, "What the? You know, why are you playing that? You know, he said, oh, that's in the movie, Stand By Me." You know, so starts singing along. And the same thing, my daughter, when she was younger, and I took her out for a ride with our dog, and I had the radio station on, and she's singing, you know, There Goes My Baby. And I said, "How do you know from 1959? How do you know the words to that?" And she said, "Well, I saw it on Sha-na-na, the TV show." And so, you know, so there you go. It's all that music that, and when my daughter was having a Sweet 16 party on our house, you know, one of the guys came over to me and said, "Do you mind if we play one of your oldie things, one of your oldie CDs?" And I'm like, "Really?" And he said, "Yeah, you know, I want to play something like, you know, Rock Around the Clock and stuff like that." And, you know, here's a kid who was 16 years old. But, you know, so, it, you know, that music, you know, it if it's good, it's good, you know. And I think that's what it's all about. It doesn't matter how old you are. You know, if you listen to that and you think it's good, that's all that matters.
Yeah. Great point. It's a great point. And, you know, and so it's funny, you know, you mentioned earlier about, you know, how the pep talk originated as an afternoon drive time. And we spent a little time talking about, you know, Harry Harrison, the morning show, the morning drive time. And it's funny because I don't know if people who listen to radio now, rarely, right, understood the importance of that. Those slots, because, you know, your morning drive time is people commuting to work, and they're listening to the radio to get the traffic and the news, like you said, the sports scores, and to listen to music to kill that time. And then for the ride home, that's that 5 to 7 p.m., the afternoon drive, and how it's very important to schedule around that.
Those are also the time where you're going to sell your most spots, probably.
Yes.
And you're going to get the highest price for those spots, commercial.
Because that's when more people are listening. That's when more ears are tuned in. And that was during a time, especially, for morning drive eventually, too. It was, I had mentioned before, you had the contemporary radio stations doing their zany Zoo Crew stuff and their prank calls and all that stuff. And then you had guys, like Don Imus and Howard Stern doing their thing. There was never any pressure for you guys to emulate any of that, right? Your leadership was confident in what you were doing, and that was the niche that needed to be served in the midst of all that craziness on either side.
Yeah, well, you know what? It's like it's like a baseball team, John. It's don't worry about the other guys. Concentrate on your team. And make sure that you've got everything you can possibly do to win that game. And it's the same thing in radio. Let's make sure our station sounds great, and everybody on that radio station has to do their job to sound great. And so I never worried about any other radio station in the market. It was like, let them worry about me. I'm just focused on on what this radio station needs to do.
That's an amazing philosophy, and I think that even transcends beyond radio and to almost any endeavor that someone sets out to do, right? Concentrate on what you're doing, and
yeah,
if what you're doing works, then the reception will be there for you.
Yeah, worry about yourself. Don't worry about the other guy because, if you're doing it right, he's just not even in the equation.
Exactly, yeah. I want to backtrack a little bit and kind of go into your origins in radio. When did you first get the radio bug, and what led you to DJing in the first place?
Well, I grew up as a kid in Nyack, New York, and listened to all the New York radio stations. And, of course, I listened to the disc jockey that I had listened to most. I guess I started when I was 11 years old listening intent to music radio. And the guy was Alan Freed, and he's the guy, as you may know, coined the term rock and roll. And he's the guy that started the wave, and everybody else followed. And I really loved to listen to him because of his enthusiasm for the music and when he was on the air. I mean, he would even do a commercial, John, by this company called Friendly Frost. I guess they were a refrigerator company or something. I don't even remember. But he did that commercial with so much enthusiasm. I said, wow, this guy's even, having fun and doing great. And, and he would always, read the requests, and he would always play the dedications. And he would do it on a one-on-one, if somebody just broke up with her boyfriend, he would read a letter from my sister did that once, and sent the letter, and he read the whole letter on the air. And so it was him, and then, after him came guys like Murray the K and Cousin Brucey and B. Mr. Reed, people like that that I really enjoyed listening to. But to tell you the truth, when I got out of high school, I knew I wasn't going to go to college because I knew it was nothing there that I wanted to study that was going to, take me on my road. So I'll never forget the day after graduation, this guy he was a friend of mine, went to another high school, and he played in a band, and I sang with a vocal group during high school, a doo-wop group. And so he came over to my house, and he said, Joe, what are you going to do next, in the fall? I said, Bobby, I really don't know. And he said, well, I went down to this radio school in New York City, Announcer Training Studios, and I went down there, and it was really cool. You should go down and see it because I know you're interested in the same stuff. He said, go see it. And he said, you and I can commute together. He said, I'll drive down to the Washington Bridge, and, we take a bus over and a subway down to to 43rd Street where the school was located. And, you know, he says, I'll get you a job in the Grand Union, you know, on a part-time. And I said, wow, this is so great, you know. And so I went down to see the school, and that was it. You know, I said, okay, we're going to do this. And we did. You know, and then we both got jobs in radio. Bobby got a job in a place called Derrida, Louisiana, and I got a job in a place called Bonham, Texas. And I was 19 years old, and I went down there, and I saw, I guess I saw racism and anti-Semitism, you know, like I've never seen before in my whole life. It was an awakening in Texas, you know, and St.
Yeah.
Louis also is where I stopped for a, I don't want to go into those stories, but anyway, and I basically, I spent about 3 weeks in Texas. I wanted to get the hell out of there. I got a job in upstate New York, and it was really a great job, but, and I stayed there for, I guess, about 3 months, and I don't know. I miss my buddies at home. I miss singing with the groups and stuff. And so I came home. And, John, I dropped out of radio for like 5 years. And during
wow.
that time, I worked at a bank, and I sang with a band 3 nights a week.
Huh.
And then
more doo-wop?
Then come, pardon me?
More doo-wop in the
no,
band that you were
singing?
No, this wasn't
doo-wop. This was more soul. This was in the 60s, so it was you know, it
cool.
elevated it into soul music, I guess, and pop top 40 stuff. And then
cool.
one morning, I'm coming home like about 4 o'clock in the morning after doing this gig at this club in Greenwood Lake, New York. And you know, I was falling asleep at the wheel, and my eyes are closing, and I see this telephone pole, and I just wake up, and I said, Joe, somebody's trying to tell you something. And so what I did was called up a friend of mine who was an engineer in New York at a radio station, WHBI. And, you know, I asked him, I said, can I come down there and just make an audition tape because I want to get back into radio? And so
huh.
in 1967, I got back into radio in 1967. And that started me. And that's how I came to Connecticut. I had two offers, one from a station in Long Island, one from a station in Connecticut. And it was closer for me to drive to the Connecticut radio station from my house in Nyack than it would be to drive to the Long Island station. So that's
yeah.
how I ended up in. That's how I ended up in Connecticut.
And then,
you know,
so
and then
you
after
were
that, it's you know, after that, it was just you know, going on to a bigger station. Somebody heard me at WAVZ in New Haven, and you know, asked me to come up and audition for them, which I did, and they gave me a gig there. And then I saw an ad in a radio trade about needing a weekend and vacation relief guy in New York City at WOR-FM. And I was a little dissatisfied at the station I was working with. And I sent them a tape, and, you know, went down for the city for an audition, and they hired me. So that was, you know, that was part of it. And then I went to WNBC, and I also went up to Connecticut in between that radio station and another to be a program director, and I actually got that job that I wasn't even, you know, searching for at the time. The guy who owned the radio station said, you know, you got all of these great ideas. We were talking, you know. He said, you got all these great ideas, so why don't you become program director? And I said, okay, you know, and that's what I did. But I was still on the air and stuff, and then I was working part-time at WCBS-FM, and, you know, and I would talk to the PDs, and I would talk to the GMs and stuff like that, and they knew me, they liked me, and one day I get a visit from someone up in Connecticut. She was a music director at CBS-FM, and she said, Joe, I think they want to hire you as program director, you know, and it came out of left field for me, and then I get a call from Nancy Woodman, who is the general manager, and she said, I would like to talk to you. You know, let's meet, and so I took the job, and I tell you, I took it more because it was the station I've always wanted to be at, because I love the music. It was the music I grew up with, and I always said that, I said to my wife, this is a labor of love for me, because,
yeah.
you know, I said, I got to try it. This is my first major market gig as a program director, and you know, if I'm going to do that, I should do it at a station that I really love with music that I really enjoy. And it was, and it was a labor of love. And I was very fortunate that, you know, management at that radio station kind of threw me the ball and said, Joe, run with it, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what I did.
Nice. Now, one thing I did find interesting is it. So you were – you started at CBS as a part-time DJ in 1975. And also, while you were there, you were also DJing from 76 to 77 at WNBC AM, 660 AM.
Well, no, that wasn't – no. What happened was is that I was doing the part-time stuff in 75, but once NBC called in 76, then, you know, I had to quit that. They weren't going to let me do that. So
I was going to ask if that was – yeah, how that worked out, because I was like,
yeah,
oh, that's interesting that you –
No,
yeah, they assumed
you,
name.
They wouldn't let you do that.
Yeah, no, I figured, yeah. And you know, again, just some of these accolades that you have in here, you were the number one program director in America for 1999 by Radio Inc. magazine, which is pretty fantastic. You also were the voted oldies program director by Radio and Record magazines for 5 years in a row, 2000 through 2005. What I find fascinating and amazing from that is that you left CBS FM in 2004, but you were so good that a year later you won that
That's
award.
That's right.
Yeah.
It was actually 2004, the last award, but I was actually gone when I got it. So, yeah, it's you know, those things are wonderful, you know, and I know every time I've won any award, you know, I've basically credited all the people that made that radio station great besides me. The on-air people, the behind the scenes people, and you know, everybody else that worked at the radio station, and you know, I really said I just never got tired of winning. You know, we were the first oldies station in a major market to become number one 12 plus five times. We did it five times. And,
yeah.
You know, most number one stations are usually, you know, contemporary music stations in most markets. And we were fortunate enough to, you know, do some things to keep our listeners, you know, listening to us. Specialty programming, like things like when we brought in all of the old disc jockeys that used to work on AM radio in New York City in the 50s, 60s. It was called the Radio Greats Weekend. We did that in 84, and then we did it like five years, you know, every 5 years after that. And I tell you what, it stopped New Yorkers in their tracks. I had one guy call me on a Sunday at the radio station, and he said, "How long have you been doing this?" And I said, "Well, we started Saturday morning." This was Sunday afternoon. He said, I just got home from England. He said, "If I knew you guys were doing this, I wouldn't have gone to England." So, I mean, you know, so that's one of the things, you know, and that's it touched so many people's hearts. You know, Phil Spector sent me a, you know, Phil Spector, right?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So Phil Spector,
the good and the bad,
genius,
but yes.
back in the 60s.
He's amazing.
He just, you know, he sent me a fax. Yes, they were using faxes back then. And, you know, and said how much he enjoyed that whole weekend and it was so great. And, you know, people flew in to see stuff like that. I mean, I was amazed. I really was. I mean, I knew that, you know, for me it was a great thrill because I grew up listening to all these guys. But it was a great thrill for everybody else because, like me, many of the people listening were the same age, and they were, you know, they were listening to these guys as kids too. So it was it was a very special part of their lives, and that's what the radio station did a lot. I mean, we touched people. We did a thing called Christmas Wish every year at Christmas time, and you know, we granted people's Christmas wishes. We asked people to write in and tell us what they wanted for Christmas, what was your Christmas wish? And then we changed it, and instead of doing it, you know, I said, well, let's do it for people who really need this stuff, not for, you know, Joe Blow who needs a new Beatle collection, you know. Let's do it let's do it for the people, like your neighbor. You know, does your neighbor, you know, need a new wheelchair? You know, does somebody have a family and they don't make enough money to put enough food on the table? Then let's do it for them. So that's what we did after that, and that, you know, and that touched people, and that to me was always the important thing. Let's touch the audience. Let's make them feel the radio station.
Yeah, that's great. And to give back to the community is always very important as well. And that you are helping people as well as being the soundtrack to their lives, which I think is very important. And it's great that you have that team, you know, in mentality. Again, because you're a big sports fan, that is just a natural, right? So I would say for you, some of the accolades you've received over the years, probably those three Marconi Awards from the National Association of Broadcasters are probably some of the more cherished accolades, because it's not just about you, it's about the station. It was the legendary station, major market station, and oldie station of the year. So those are probably more meaningful to you than some of the other personal accolades.
Absolutely. I think, you know, especially the legendary one, John.
Yeah.
When someone says you're legendary, you know, I mean the whole radio station and everybody that's part of it, I mean, what else can you say? I mean, that guy says
right.
It all. You know, everybody knows who you are. You know, it's like the Lone Ranger. You know, everybody knows who you are.
Yeah.
The legend of the Lone Ranger. The legend of radio. And
yeah.
That's what that radio station was, you know. And it was a great part of people's lives and people's hearts, you know. And people still talk about it to this day.
Yeah. And as far as, you know, hearing, you know, being told, now I've personally never been told a legend, but I've relayed this story before on another episode. But I had an opportunity to meet a comic book artist, one of the legendary comic book artists, Neil Adams. And he was a big sports fan, and he drew the Superman versus Muhammad Ali comic. And I had a chance to meet him a few years before my father passed. And I introduced myself and I told him who my father was, and he just looked at me straight in the eyes and goes, "Your father is a legend." And
there you go.
For me to hear that from a guy that, you know, something that I really love, like that was huge. And I related to my father, and even though, you know, the name of the man didn't quite have that sort of weight as for my father
right.
as it did for me, to know that somebody that is considered a legend in his field looked at my father and said, you know, he's a legend. You know, that really meant a lot to my father as well. And it's really funny, a little side note about Neil Adams, when he was around, you know, we lost him, unfortunately, this year. I would ask him, I said, "Oh, can you make it out to, you know, Phil Pepe?" Because I had him sign something for my dad. And he said, "No, I'm just going to make it to Phil. Your father knows his own last name." I just thought that was a really, really neat thing. I was like, "Oh, yeah, fair enough." So,
well, that's great.
I
mean, that's, you know, it's you know, he's Phil was a great guy, and I, you know, I couldn't thank him enough for inviting me just about every year. I mean, basically every year to the New York Writers Baseball Dinner. You know, and it's funny because I sat with you guys, your whole family usually, it's funny because that dinner was always like in between the Super Bowl, you know, Bowl week.
Usually the weekend before,
the weekend before.
Or 2 weeks
and
before, yeah.
It was always like a cold Sunday night, and, you know, and I would have to come in from Connecticut, and I would sit home sometimes and say, "Man, I don't really want to go in tonight. You know, I don't really want to go in." You know, but I would go in, and once I got there, it was like, you know, you saw these guys, you saw them, all these like 20 ball players walk in to receive all these awards, you know, both current ball players and retired ball players. And it was just, you know what, it got the adrenaline flowing. You couldn't wait for, you know, the baseball season to come. So it was great. It was always great. And, you know, I can never thank him enough for that. Having introduced Mickey, and when you're with someone like like your dad, who is a sports writer and who these ball players know and like. You know, a lot of sports writers they don't like, but your dad was one guy that, you know, they really liked. And so when you're meeting a Mickey Mantle with Phil Pepe or Yogi Berra with Phil Pepe or a Billy Martin with Phil Pepe, it's a lot different than meeting him by yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah, he really did have a good rapport. You know, he definitely was about the psychology of the game, you know, what goes into being a baseball player. But he was also really effective as a writer because he could, like you said, make that create that unbiased word picture. You know, I've always said, you know, the reason my father was a great objective sports journalist, especially for baseball, there's a misconception he was a Yankee fan because a lot of his friends were Yankees and he was the beat writer. He traveled with these guys during that period. But he was a Brooklyn Dodger fan. And
I know that.
When they left Brooklyn, he never migrated his allegiance to Los Angeles. He never grafted onto the Mets. He never brought that to the Yankees. It was the Brooklyn Dodgers, and that was it. There was no other team to root for. And one of the two times I ever saw my father actually cry was a trip to Cooperstown that we took. And he wandered into the Ebbets Field display where they had, you know, this mock-up of the facade and they're playing there used to be a ballpark around here. And, you know, we had kind of gotten separated and I caught up with him and I just see him sitting there just looking at that mock-up of the facade and just rolling a tear. And it was that and the end of Field of Dreams when we saw that for the first time in the theater. Two times I saw my father cry.
Well, you know, he was that, you know, he was that little kid back then. We all were little kids. And when you grow up with something like that, you know, I mean, that's really important. That's kind of like your first love. And I used to kid your dad a lot. You know, I said, Phil, the only reason why the Brooklyn Dodgers won the 55 World Series is because Mickey was out.
Dad.
Said, oh, don't say that, Joe. Don't say that, Joe.
That's great. You know, and so along the track of legends, you also worked with and had a really good relationship with Don Imus, you know, who we mentioned before, who was very much a legend, you know, and an innovator for what he did. You know, where Don Imus led, everybody else just managed to follow, right?
Yeah.
And one of the greatest compliments I think that anybody could have ever received was when someone was doing a profile on you. They asked Don Imus, you know, about, you know, oh, we want to talk to you about Joe McCoy. And the first thing, I love Joe McCoy. And to get that as an instinctual first response from Don Imus means you're doing something right.
Well, I guess, you know, I'll tell you what, it's you know, everybody looks at Imus one way, and since I followed him on the air when I was at WNBC, so I would come in early, and, you know, we'd talk radio once we got to know each other. Well, we started talking radio, and he loved radio. He really enjoyed radio. He really loved talking about radio, and that's what we would do. And even when I left there and went to CBS FM, you know, he would call me every once in a while, you know, and ask about certain songs or certain things, you know, CDs or whatever. And then my friends would tell me every once in a while, he would mention me on the air about something, you know. And so I thought, you know, I said, you know, that's really cool. You know, I really appreciate somebody doing like that, something like that, especially with a, you know, with a guy who's, you know, who's so well known, you know, but we got along. We always got along, you know, so it's, you know, after the first day I was there and, you know, he said something smart to me and I said something smart right back at him.
There
and,
you,
you know, and it kind of leveled the playing field and we became friendly.
Joe McCoy, you can run with the big guys. There's no doubt about that. so we got a little over 10 minutes left. So, you know, let's talk about your other love besides radio, your love of baseball. I know that you are a Yankee fan. Were you a Brooklyn Dodger fan that betrayed the team when they betrayed migrated over to the Yankees?
I was always a Yankee fan. I grew up a Yankee fan. And my cousin, who's 3 years older than me, He was a really good baseball player. I wish I had the athleticism that he had. But he was a Brooklyn Dodger fan. And, you know, we would, we'd watch Dodger games at his house and Yankee games at my house. And I got to like the Dodgers. I mean, don't get me wrong. They were my, you know, I liked them in the National League because I was always I was a big fan of Carl Furillo and Gil Hodges. And I'm really happy that Hodges is going to the Hall of Fame this year.
Yes.
I mean, he was just such a good guy and a damn good ball player who looked great in that baseball uniform. And, you know, big part of Brooklyn. I mean, Brooklyn loved him. He could do no wrong. You know, if Hodges went into a slump, you know, nobody booed him. Nobody booed him in Brooklyn because he was part of the neighborhood.
Yep, yeah.
Yeah, no, I was always a Yankee fan. I grew up a Yankee fan, and probably because of my uncle who used to take me to all the ball games, and he was a Yankee fan. So, and they had pictures in my uncle's bar downstairs in my grandmother's house of like the 1950 Yankees or something like that. You know, individual pictures. So it probably ingrained in my mind when I was a little kid, you know, that I was going to be a Yankee fan, which was a good thing because. You know, they kind of cleaned house in the 50s and early 60s.
yes, they did in a big way. Yeah. I always look at those real lean years, right? Sort of like after the first 5 years of Saturday Night Live, when they just ditched the Not Ready for Prime for Nine players, and those first couple seasons after that, that was like the Yankees, like right around just before Steinbrenner bought them.
Yeah. It's I think they had their lean years, and you know, from 65 till they came back in 76. They were building things back, and you know, I'll tell you about Cleve Boyer was my last favorite Yankee at third baseman back in the 60s.
Yep.
And they traded Cleve Boyer before the 1967 season. And I went to Yankee Stadium in 67 at the beginning of the season, and I was really peeved because they let Cleve Boyer go. And I went there, and I said, you know, who are these guys, you know? I mean, everybody was pretty much gone by then, so except for Mickey, and he should have been gone. But, you know, Whitey was gone, and all the other guys were gone that I grew up with. And I said, well, you know what? They traded Cleve. I don't need to root for them anymore. You know, I'll root for Billy Martin's teams and stuff. So I didn't go to a Yankee game, you know, from 1968 to August of 1975. And I went there because it was an old-timers game, and there was going to be a bus trip. And a buddy of mine said, let's go. You know, it's at Chase Stadium. I said, okay, what the hell, you know? And then as I'm driving to my buddy's house, I hear on the radio that Billy Martin has just become manager on Old Timers Day. And so I'm going down to this game, and I was like, you know, I got the juice flowing again. And because I love Billy Martin as a player.
Of course.
So I got the juices flowing again, and I loved him as a manager too. But, you know, and I said, oh, okay, this is great. And that Christmas I asked my wife to buy me a book called Dynasty, which you know, which told all about the Yankees of those great years. And, you know, I became a Yankee fan again.
Nice. Real quick, I guess, greatest baseball game that you ever attended?
I'm going to say the Game 6 of the 1996 World Series. Because the Yankees were I love that team, first of all. And I love Jeter. I loved everybody on that team, Jimmy Key and Andy Pettit and all those guys. They had a great team. And, you know, it was the first opportunity for me, believe it or not, to be at a Yankee World Series. I mean, I went to Game 1 and I went to a few other games. But to see them win in 96, it was euphoric. I mean, it was just unbelievable, just unbelievable. And I came out of that stadium, and it was, like, so quiet when you came out. You know, it was like, I guess everybody was just exhausted. They couldn't even talk anymore. But it was a great game, and see Girardi hit that, you know, hit that, what was it, a double or a triple? A triple. It was a triple. see him hit that triple, knock in the first run, I was like, wow. I was like, this is unbelievable.
Yes, yeah. I was at college for that, so I was actually watching that. And the excitement, the electricity was just beaming through the television, so I can imagine what it was like to be there. It must have been incredible.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
We're going to wrap it up a little bit here. We have about 6 minutes left or five and a half minutes, well, 5 minutes left. And so you left CBS FM in 2004. And, I will venture to say that the station probably was never the same with your departure. But what did you do after that? Was that retirement for Joe McCoy, or did you take
your
talent
elsewhere?
Well, you
know what? CBS retained me as sort of a consultant for about a year. Really, I didn't have to do anything, but, it was...
Just listen to the radio. Wow, how terrible
was it? Listen to the radio. But after that, I consulted a radio station down on the Jersey Shore for a year. And then I also consulted some of the PBS rock and roll TV shows, along with an Italian one, because I helped pick out some of the songs, for T.J. Labinsky, who... produces a lot of the music stuff for PBS and also for Channel 13 in New York City. So I did some stuff like that. And then basically after that, I said, you know what, I'm just going to retire. And a buddy of mine had a show called Inside, Talking Inside Yankee Baseball at a station in New Haven, Connecticut. And, he asked me if I wanted to come on with him, like on Saturday mornings and, be one of the co-hosts. And I said, yeah, that'd be fun because I love baseball. So it'd be an easy task for me to, sit in and talk about it. So we did that for, I think, a couple of years. And then we all decided to say sayonara. And, and so that's it. So now I'm retired, and we do some traveling, and sometimes watch our granddaughter, and go to baseball games here and there. And I just went to one last week.
First
time in
three
years.
That was a good one.
That was a good one. Yeah, the Yankees won when you come home with a W. It's a good one.
Always. Well, you know what, man? I think we barely scratched the surface of some of your experiences. I would love to see you write a book. I would love to see you take some time and put some of those memories on paper, because I think that, what you did for that era, like I said, it really defined New York. It defined my life. There's no doubt about that. In a day and age where just about any schmo can steal a name of a segment on CBS FM radio and call it a podcast, you that kind of trail, blazed that trail for me. And in a lot of ways, you were definitely very inspirational for me being here now doing this. And I really enjoy having these conversations with people that have both inspired me and influenced me and, kind of getting to know a little bit more. You were more than my father's boss. You were a member of the family. You are always welcome at the table, even though we don't do the dinner anymore. But maybe this fall in October, you want to come down to New Jersey from Connecticut. I would love to bring you to the Chiller Theater Convention. You would really enjoy the nostalgia vibe that they provide. I think that's something you would really enjoy experiencing. My phone line's always open to you, or the messenger. But thank you so much for being here, for doing this, for helping me prepare for this interview. And really quick before we go, how can people get in contact with you if they ever just want to reach out to you?
Well, if they ever want to reach out to me, I don't know, John. I don't give that information out. But to tell you the truth, let me just say this: I appreciate everybody who listened on the radio, whether I was a DJ in New York City or Connecticut, or as a program director, and people who love CBS FM. That was such a great time in my life, and you know, the most fond memories of radio. When radio was radio.
Exactly,
and it was,
exactly.
And it was a lot of fun. And I'm so happy, John, that, you know, you're doing this and you're keeping the pep talk, the name, the pep talk going, I guess, you know, in honor of your father. I'm assuming that's why you did it. But,
of course.
You know, so it's a great thing, and it's always great to talk to a peppy.
Well, thank you again for everything, Joe. You really are a legend, and you know, your endorsement means a lot to me. You coming on here means a lot to me. Again, I hope talk to you again in the near future. Folks, that's going to wrap it up. Tomorrow's the 4th of July, so you know what? Happy birthday, America. May all the gods bless and keep you. Thank you for listening to the Pep Talk. Good night.